Mr. Brian Rock, Rail 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Rock?
I'm actually born and bred in Middlesbrough. I was born on the 16th of May 1934, just 500 yards from where I live now, actually. I was the first baby, it was a brand new estate, and I was the first baby ever born on that estate. So that estate is just over the road here, getting pulled down now. It's 70 year old.
Can you tell us a bit about your family background?
My mum, she was in service as a young lady. We don't know a lot about my mum's family because her mum and dad was actually dead before we were born. And I just knew her sisters. She had three sisters, Nellie, Elizabeth, and I just forget the other name.
Doesn't matter.
And but my father's family, they were a well-off family, but for some unknown reason, my father was the most proud and stubborn man you ever met in your life. He was born with just one hand, and he wouldn't let no one do anything for him. He wouldn't let the family do anything for him. And they wanted to do things for him, and he wouldn't let them. And the family, my father's name is Albert Newsham - Rock. We are just Rock. He dropped the - Newsham, and so did the two brothers and sister. For what reason, we don't know. But the side of the family was rich. Well-off person. My great-grandmother, I can remember her as a bairn, she owned most of old Middlesbrough, which was at the time we talked about years ago, we used to call it over the border, which was over the railway from here, and it was the old town. And that's where. But my father had a very good brain. He calculated things out, and when you think of it today, it's just like a computer. He wouldn't say what was nine nines. He'd say nine tens and take the nine off. You know what I mean? Which was an easy way of doing it. And he drilled it into us, and that's about the only education I had.
Now, what did he do for a living?
My father was a road sweeper. See, with one hand and one arm. He wouldn't take any job at the family. The family had a business called, it was a chemical business, but it was mainly bones, animal bones used to come in. And I think they used to create them. No, I think they used to go to do something with scent. But there used to be a big boneyard at the other end of the town there, and you used to see millions of rats at the bone when you were walking down at night time. It was pretty scary, actually.
So how was the family? I mean, how many were there in your family? It was you, there's your dad and your mum and you. And
I had an older brother, he died, Albert. Then there was myself, and then my next one was a sister called Brenda, who was actually murdered. She was actually murdered. Then a brother called Barry, still alive today. A sister called Betty, still alive.
So it was a big family.
A brother called Kevin, still alive. And a sister called Beryl, who was the first known case of leukemia. In 1944, she was born in 1944. And they used to treat these children as pneumonia. And after they dropped the atomic bomb, they realised that there was something with the thing, genes, you know, and they found out that she was one of these things. And they kept her alive for about 18 months while they did experiments. The hospital's gone now, but we used to call it the fever hospital. Anyone that died in there, their own hospital and their own cemetery at the back, because they used to have smallpox and stuff like that, diphtheria cases, and they're all buried there.
Now, there were that many of you, and your dad a road tripper, money must have been tight.
Money was tight, but we didn't ever have agony. My mum worked as well.
What did she? She was.
My mother's sisters all had dealings in fish shops, and she worked in one of the fish shops for her sister.
Was it a happy childhood for you, you know?
Oh, I think so, yeah. Yeah, it was a happy childhood.
Now, tell us about your education.
My education was virtually nil. You know, we come... them days you used to have your... I think it was 11 plus and things like that. And I don't think I did well at anything, educational-wise.
Which school did you go to?
I went to the school. It's just on the bottom there. It's called Archibald School. It's still there today, Archibald School. And today it's one of the top schools in the area for the young'uns now. It's only a primary school.
Now, why didn't you do very well at school? Why do you think it was?
I think it was because of the war years, the disruption. We didn't have no teachers. The teachers that we had were like volunteers. And consequently, all you got was art, a little bit of rudiment education in maths. You didn't get no logarithms or anything like that. Because the people that were teaching you didn't know that. There was the war years, you know, people came in on a voluntary service. And the school itself was, wasn't actually hit by a bomb, but the bomb hit 50 yards away and took most of the school away, like. So that was in disruption. I think that was why, because I left in 49.
Now, tell us about the effects of the war. What about the bombing? Did you see much of the bombing? I mean, I know
we
you
did
were
actually.
Young. I mean, you were what?
Oh, we thoroughly enjoyed it. Just to the north of us from here was one of the biggest bomber commands in the country, Thornaby Air Station. And we used to just go down at the bottom of the top of the street here, and we could see them going, taking off. And then it was late at night now, and we back up there early in the morning, counting them in. And you know, and then you knew that there was so many never come back. But we used to go around, and after raids, we used to go around collecting shrapnel. You know, it was a hobby. You know, the pieces. Metal, unbelievable shrapnel. But where we lived a few times, but we were very near. The gas tanks in Middlesbrough actually had a bomb right away through the middle without blowing up. And that was unbelievable, because if that went up, it would have took most of Middlesbrough with it at the time. Yes, it was. I say for kids, it was enjoyable.
And what about, did you have an air raid shelter?
Yes, we had an air raid shelter.
What type was it?
Anderson, in the garden itself.
And what you might remember of being in that as a kid?
We didn't go in very often. I think parents got, after a certain length of time, in and out, and the distance away. With Middlebury was very, very fortunate. The fact that there are a hell of a lot of chemical and steelworks. And if you fly in from the coast to Middlebury, with the hills all the way around, when the chemical and the things, all you seen was the hills. You never seen Middlebury. And it saved them getting a hell of a pasting. You got some... August Bank Holiday in 1944. Everyone was going out a red car from the Middlebury Railway Station, and the air raid warnings went. And the aircraft come right over the railway station. And the air is out now. They emptied the station. The train pulled out. And it come round for the second time. And it dropped three bombs smack in the middle of the station. And the only casualty was a porter. The other plane was actually shot down. And the bomb aimer of that plane became a good friend of mine years later. He'd been forced into the Luftwaffe because his family was there and said, well, you do it or your family gets thing. He said, I could have dropped the bombs the first time. He said, I've seen the train. And he still lives in Middlesbrough. Yeah, retired and still lives here.
Now, what about the effects of things like rationing, food rationing? Did that bother you much as a kid? Were you aware of it?
You were aware of it for the fact that, well, I say it was a good thing, because people of my generation all have their own teeth, because there were no candies. And say my mother worked for a sister in a fish shop, and she used to bring big lumps of lard home. And I was in the Army Cadets, and we had a camp just outside of it, Middlebury, called Easby. And we used to go there every weekend. And when it was the long holidays, you were there for the generation. But I used to get, for the fact that I used to be able to take all the lard, you know.
What about clothing rationing? Did that affect much?
Well, you got handed down, do you know what I mean? You didn't have no new time gear, you know, what they have these days. It was handed down generation to generation.
Now, what about this Army Cadet business? When did you join them?
I joined them in 1946, I think it was.
Oh, so that's after the war. So, hang on, now, come on. Do you remember the end of the war? Were there any celebrations that you were part of?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I remember the celebrations. We didn't have one in our street, but the main road, which was Acton Road now, they had one. The thing, because when it was the invasion during the war, all the troops, I think, had been based up in around about Elgin and around that way. And when they were bringing all the stuff up for the invasion, they come through Middlesbrough and they stop at night time and ask people, you know, people used to can a boiling water, you know, so they could have a brew up and everything. And they went on for days and days, this convoy going through all the time, you know. You wouldn't have thought there was that many vehicles.
You were telling me about the VE Day celebration.
No, there's going down for the Normanby landings. That was all the start of it, yeah. Going down. But the same road had the celebration, the where cut of bunting and stuff like that out and. A few cakes as they had, you know, everyone made a few cakes, and that's how you do it. It was like your own entertainment.
And so, what year did you leave school?
1949.
Right, so you joined the Army Cadets before that. Now, what were you doing with the Army Cadets?
Well, it was just put the Army Cadets in. It was virtually just an army like career, you know, you learn to march and discipline and just normal army thing, you know, shooting.
Where were they based at?
Just a couple of hundred yards over the road here. It's still there, Stock and Drill Hall.
And what type of stuff were you doing? I mean, drill, how did you do, you know? Tell us a bit more about it.
Well, He was just like a marching squad on a parade ground, you know, you march up and down, and then you had the rifles and your slope arms and presented arms, and you had all the kit, you were like a little soul, you know, the putties and everything. It was there. Oh, we used to think it was fabulous. Every Saturday used to be at the cadets, like, you know.
And what about these camps? What were they like? What would you do at the camps?
I only went to one camp. I went to Troon, and the Ayrshire thing. It's now, I think it's a Butlins camp. What used to be the arm camp there. But we went there for a fortnight. Well, training, but I don't know what training we did. I was on about this the other week with a mate of mine. All I think is we had a hell of a good time going up, throwing and swimming and things like that, you know. But the other camp we had, there was just outside the town, a place called Easby. There was just one barracks, one thing, a camp, a cookhouse, a barrage balloon, an anti-aircraft gun. And after the first couple of years of the war, it was disbanded. So we used to use the Captain Riley, I always remember, I think he used to take us up there for the weekends. And we used to walk from there. It's about 15 miles, and we used to walk there and walk back all the time. I never think out of it.
Now, so you left school in 1949, and what were you going to do then?
I went straight in the Royal Navy.
Now, how did that come about? How did you come to join the Royal Navy?
It was just something I always wanted to do. I wanted to go to sea. I wanted to see the world.
And you weren't called up, you volunteered.
Oh, no, I was a boy. And I went from here to HMS Ganges.
And what month did you go there? I know you're not good on dates, you remember?
It was the end of the year.
End of 1949?
Yeah.
December?
November, December, yeah.
Now, what do you remember that, when you went to HMS Ganges? It's a shore station, obviously. What was your reception when you got there?
Oh, we arrived there about, I remember it was at night time, and there was two parts of the camp. One for what were they call the nozzers, that's the new people coming in. And the other people, they'd been in there maybe a fortnight, you know, but they knew it all then. And you were kept separate. You had to get all your kit.
What do you remember of kitty now? What did you get given?
Oh, everything. Pajamas, running gear, sports gear, tropical uniforms, normal uniforms, what we call number eights, like jeans on top. Everything, socks, vests, and everything had to be stamped. You had a stamp. And then I was fortunate, B Rock. I had five, everything had to be sewed in. But some of them, you had, I always remember, and I'll never forget as long as I live. It was MacDonald of MacDonald's. He was the chief of the MacDonald clan. And because when you got some, everyone used to muck in. And now, he did it because the full mess depended on how well you all did. And no use you getting yours done with a short name sitting back. You still had to wait for them, and so you mucked in. And then you were there, I think, 6 weeks.
Now, what were your barrack rooms? Oh, well, the huts, like?
It's just like normal huts there. You're in a naval hut, you go in a passage. It's all set. You've got left and right, you have toilets and ablution centres. And then you have a square, which is a polished square. Your boots come off before you go into that polished square. And then you go on to your beds, all your beds are laid out, you know, across from each other.
Now, what was a typical day's training like, just to cover the training?
Well, that was when you might call the boys, you spent all your time, doing all your kit and everything. But after, I think it was fortnight or 3 weeks, you went into the big camp. And the mess I was in, it used to be called a short covered way. It was right in the parade ground. My block was HMS Drake, and the mast was down. It's still there today. It's the biggest sailing mast in the world, 260 feet high. And that was one of the things you had to do.
In terms of climbing the mast, you had to climb.
And there was no shortcuts going through. You had to go over and out. Over and out. And the one stipulation they did give, you didn't actually have to stand on the button, but you had to go to the top and touch the button. But after a while, you got used to it.
I mean, were you scared of heights? So?
Well, I didn't very well like them very much. I don't think anyone does that. But it's the thing you had to do. And I say a typical once a week you'd have the thing. There was in this camp you're talking about thousands of boys, all in different weeks of education, like, you know. And the 1 week you were doing that, another week you first. The forenoon of every day was always education.
Now, well, tell us about that.
You got new stuff that I didn't get from school. You know, maths and English. That's mainly the two subjects. Like, but then, if you took on I was told, I didn't want to, I told you were a telegraphist and that's it, like, you know. So then you had to do a part of the afternoon, you had to do your own training. And that's you had to pass out at the end of the course and be able to read Morse at 25 words a minute.
Well, tell us how they taught you Morse then.
I always remember they started off with Morse. They started off with a dit, which is an E, two dits, I, three dits, S, four dits, H. And I went through that then, dit and a da, and a da, dit, A and N, opposite each other. And that's how I went through your thing. But same now you actually learnt the Morse code, you were actually learning to type as well, which was a strange instrument, you know, but you learn to tape because part of a community's thing, not these days, but what it was, it used to be, teleprinters, you know, you used to get worldwide communication with teleprinters. You couldn't with Morse. You used to get them into the Atlantic and you were finished. You had the only way to get, say, to England from the middle of the Atlantic was to go through a relay ship and they relay the message for you. Nowadays with the satellites there, worldwide communication is 24 hours a day.
Tell us about the teleprinters, what were they like?
Teleprinters were big, like a huge teleprinters to sell, you know, huge things. But the electronic touch of them, they weren't manual, you know, so you touch it, it went. So you had to get, you could be cack-handed and but it's also, you used to do a tape as you were going, and the tape would cut out, so that if you made mistakes, you could just do the tape and tape it over the part you'd done. And at the end of it, had a message that could be read. But not only that, you had to learn to read a light.
What, signalling light?
The signalling light, yeah. You had to read semaphore flags. You know, a dollar. You were sworn in to do ciphers, communication. You did all the ciphers as well on ship.
Now tell us about your cipher training.
Well, you did is you went to a normal classroom and then it showed you what type of I forget what they call it nowadays, but it's something like the Enigma. You put them in and turn them around about five or six, and I just forget what it was called. But it was something very similar.
And at what level of cipher were you operating? I mean, were you doing a lot of cipher training? Or
well, when you were in Korea, you had to read everything because it was all...
Oh, we'll come back. Right, okay.
It was all cipher, you
what
know.
What about seamanship training?
You got a little bit. You didn't get much of it as a communicator. I think it was the bare essentials, and that was it.
A what, sorry?
The bare essentials, you know, me being up the march, you know. And that was about it, because you were never given a rifle.
No, seamanship training.
Yeah, but seamanship, you didn't do no, because it didn't concern you, you know, on a ship.
So you just didn't learn about boats or any rules of the things or knots or anything like that, splices?
Well, you did, because you picked them up yourself, you know what I mean? You wouldn't sit there and not... Well, I don't think many people, but I can do most of the knots and things. But it's just something, what you weren't learned, it's just what you picked it up. If you were a dabto, then you learned it. But as a communicator, you didn't. You did learn there's some splices for radio wire, you know, that you had to know. But it wasn't. It was just straightforward splicing a wire so that you could put up as a radio mast.
Now, how did you get on with the other lads?
Oh, I got on great with them. One of them... I was friendly with him until about 10 years ago. We both come out in 1959, out the Royal Navy, and he was married to an Irish girl from Ballymena.
I'm talking about when you were at HMS Ganges.
Yeah, well, this is one of the lads that was with me at HMS Ganges, like J.G. Evans, I'll never forget his name. I got on with a lot of them. There's one of them phones is up now.
Was there any bullying?
I think it must have been, but I didn't come across it.
What about the instructors? What were they like?
Oh, well, obviously, they're all everyone called pigs, and that's it, you know what I mean? Because you had to have discipline, and you just can't have a conventional bloody rule of thing without... bullying an area, you know, they make sure that you should know who's the top man, and that's it, and you do as you're told.